This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. So, welcome today to Dr. Amanda Jiang on Research Review, CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirad, and I'm here with my co-host, Gurman Gill. And just to start off, we'd like to introduce Dr. Jiang. She is an assistant professor in the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at UBC. And Dr. Jiang has a Master's of Science and PhD from MIT. That's correct, right? And you also did a postdoc at Harvard, I believe, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Excellent.
And just to clarify, actually, the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability is its own department, and then mechanical engineering is a separate department. I know it's confusing because one's an institute and one's a department, but they're two separate things.
Okay, excellent. And today we're going to be talking about a study that was recently published December 2020 in Volume 15 of Environmental Research Letters. And that study is Cumulative Air Pollution Indicators Highlight Unique Patterns of Injustice in Urban Canada. And Dr. Jiang was a co-author on that paper along with Caitlin Castellani. But just before we begin... is there anything else you'd like to say about yourself, Dr. Jiang?
Sorry, you've also caught me at the end of the day, so I'm a little bit loopy. What else would I like to say about myself? So I joined UBC in 2018. My research area and the research area for my group is broadly focused on using modeling and data science tools to inform decision-making around pollution, climate, and energy issues, but with a particular interest in issues around air pollution, health, and equity. And so that links to the study that we'll talk about today.
Excellent. And just about the study that we're talking about today, would you like to provide a little bit of an overview about just what it basically covers?
Yeah, so the starting point for this work is that air pollution is a really major contributor to the global burden of disease. This is true all over the world, including places like Canada, even though from a global perspective, Canada has relatively good air quality compared to other places in the world. So we know air pollution is a major contributor to disease. Something else that we know, though, is that air pollution isn't equally distributed. There are some communities that are more exposed to air pollution impacts. And this is what we would call a form of environmental injustice. And so when I say that, I mean, the unequal distribution of environmental risks and benefits, where the burden of the risks and lack of access to benefits is mainly falling on racialized communities, indigenous communities, low-income communities, and other socially disadvantaged communities. So that's something that, that's an awareness that we have. It's true in many places in the world, and a lot of the research around that really kind of came out of research starting in the U.S., but it's actually, Canada is we have less of a sense of what exactly this looks like in Canada. And in particular, one of the areas that we wanted to look at in this study was exposure to multiple kinds of air pollution. Because like in the real world, like when you're breathing, you're not just breathing in one thing, you're breathing in a mixture of things. So one of the things we wanted to try to understand was, how are different communities in urban Canada exposed to a mixture of pollutants or what we call like cumulative air pollution? And we thought it was really important to kind of develop a really Canada-specific understanding of this, because that's what we need to inform policymaking in Canada at various levels of government. So that's what we wanted to look at in the study. One of the things that we found were that When we look at cumulative air pollution, so like multiple different kinds of air pollution, we do see different patterns of injustice in terms of which communities are disproportionately exposed to cumulative air pollution between different cities in Canada. So we looked at Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal. So that was one of the key things we found. And another key thing we found is that indeed you see different patterns when you're looking at cumulative pollution versus the individual pollutants.
Excellent. Now, basically, one of the first questions I have is that, you know, there's a lot of data in this paper, for example, that you used to basically determine what is the level of pollution of certain pollutants in different neighborhoods and different areas of the city. And basically, how is the analysis for this performed? How would you say this data was collected? Where did it come from?
Yeah, so this is definitely one of those cases where we're standing on the shoulders of giants. What made this research possible, and one of the reasons we wanted to do this research, is that there's a huge body of work in Canada that's just trying to understand the distribution of air pollution in Canada. So we were using data sets that came from a variety of different groups and communities for estimating concentrations of the four different air pollutants we look at all over Canada. And the methods that they use are a combination of different things. So sometimes the data comes from direct measurements, so like places where we can like measure exactly what the air pollution levels are. It also incorporates things like modeling. So, you know, the reality is that we can't actually measure everywhere, unfortunately. It's you know, cost prohibitive, there are logistical challenges. So there are different things that we might do to try to model what air pollution looks like, you know, the places where we can't measure it. Something else that helps, though, is satellite measurements. So, like, with satellites, we can look at lots of places. We can get a really good spatial coverage. So I would say that the data sets we use kind of combine these three different sources to try to generate estimates of what air pollution looks like across Canada. And so, like I said, that's, you know, huge thank you to the other research groups that have produce those data sets that make it possible for us to do this kind of analysis. So that's the data on the air pollution side. The other part of this question, though, when we're talking about distributional environmental injustice, is of course like the people side. So for the people side of the data, we rely on data sets from the Canadian Census, and that data looks at different kinds of socio-demographic attributes. So things related to, for instance, household income. That's one of the dimensions we look at. You know, whether you identify as part of a visible minority, indigeneity, immigrant status. Those are the ones that we looked at in this study.
Interesting. And now this the census data you mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. That data, basically, it shows where, for example, each individual on a geographic scale would live, right?
Yeah. Yes, that's what the census data shows. For privacy reasons and identifiability reasons, you can't, for the most part, for the public, Statistics Canada doesn't let you, like, you can't find out, for instance, like, exactly who your neighbor is. So the Statistics Canada provides that data aggregated at something more like a neighborhood level, or what we would call a dissemination area level. So you can get that data publicly available. Anyone can. You can download it from Statistics Canada that looks kind of at a neighborhood scale what the demographics look like.
That's pretty interesting. Gurman, do you have any questions?
So from what I understand, a lot of the pollution is distributed to, is it just major cities, or would it also include like rural communities that also involve minorities?
It's a really good question, because certainly air pollution is not something that just affects urban communities. You know, air pollution is also, it can be an issue, for instance, like downwind of cities, and there are different kinds of air pollution issues that might affect rural communities. So what we do know, though, is that there are different sources of air pollution, and some of those matter more or less in different areas. So in an urban context, some of the sources of air pollution that really are significant is traffic, for instance. So Traffic-related air pollutants is something that's, of course, much more an issue often in urban areas where you have like a high density of roadways, and then also non-road, you know, things like airports, marine terminals, trains. These are all sources of kind of transport-related air pollution. Urban centers are often also centers of industrial activity as well. So that's another source of air pollution. But that's also sometimes true of more rural locations. For instance, coal-fired power plants, we don't often see those as much in urban centers. And in Canada, often they're a little bit removed. Right? So there are different kinds of air pollution sources that will matter in different kinds of places. In this study, one of the reasons, though, that we wanted to look at urban centers, or we chose urban centers to look at as a first cut, kind of links to that census data question that Eliro just brought up, and it has to do with the resolution at which we have data about people. And one of the things is, for those identifiability reasons, in an urban center, you can get data at a finer spatial resolution just because there are more people, versus in a more rural area, where when they're aggregating the data up, the area actually ends up being much larger. So that makes it actually harder to look at some of the finer scale variations, I guess, in air pollution that drive some of the inequalities that we observe in exposure.
Interesting. We'll be right back here on Research Review after just one message, so please stay tuned.
Are you one of those, I really want to make a podcast, people? Well, we've got a huge opportunity to share with you. StoryHive is giving away 10 grants of $10,000 each to aspiring podcasters in BC and Alberta. Since 2013, TELUS StoryHive has funded and supported emerging creators with mentorship and guidance from the National Screen Institute, bringing hundreds of creative Western Canadian projects to life. This time, they're taken to the airwaves with their inaugural podcast edition, dropping on November 4th. StoryHive is looking for original nonfiction podcast concept pitches from BC and Alberta residents. Make sure you apply before December 2nd at storyhive.com, and you could get $10,000 to get your podcast off the ground. That's storyhive.com for all the details.
So now we are back here on Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, and my name is Ali Rod, along with my co-host Gurman. Today we have been interviewing Dr. Amanda Jiang, and so far we've been talking a bit about the issue of air pollution in Canadian cities. So now, looking at Vancouver, what would you say was the most significant findings you found in Vancouver? What factor do you think would explain most of the discrepancies in exposure to air pollution, basically, in the population?
Yeah, so I should have said this earlier. So yes, we looked at how exposure to outdoor air pollution where you live overlaps with these various socio-demographic variables, so that we can understand where there are disparities in terms of who's exposed, and in particular, whether like some of these communities that are already socially marginalized are experiencing higher exposure, and the different kinds of social stratification or dimensions of vulnerability that we wanted to look at were things like low income status, immigration status, racialization, and Indigenous identity. So one of the things that we found for Vancouver was that Indigenous, you know, out of those four categories that we looked at, Indigenous residents bear the highest burden of, have the highest cumulative pollution burdens. Or sorry, what I should say is that compared to non-Indigenous residents, so like the relative pollution burden for Indigenous residents is the largest compared to these other categories.
That's pretty interesting. And one other thing that I noticed that was mentioned was that you said that visible minorities do not face a higher pollution burden compared to the other groups in Vancouver, but you also noted that certain groups such as the Black, Arab, and West Asians face higher pollution burdens. Now, one question I have from the data is where do these ethnic groups tend to reside, and why would you say that they are more exposed to pollution, for example, compared to other groups?
Yeah, so I think you get at a really important point, which is that the complexity of what some of these, you know, categories are. And like I said, we got the data from the census, and the census has these different categories for, you know, like what the census calls like visible minority. And that's a whole bunch of, it's like a complex thing, right? Like what is included in that are racialized groups, certain ethnic racialized groups. And what we find is that when you use that kind of, that term visible minority, it encompasses a lot, and it erases, or if you just look at it, it kind of glosses over some of the differences we might see even just like within that category, right? Like between different groups that make up, you know, what the census in Canada calls visible minority groups. So yeah, like you noted, what we found is that if you look at visible minorities as a whole in Vancouver, they're not necessarily they're not experiencing higher cumulative pollution burdens than the white population in Vancouver. But if you disaggregate that and you look at some of these different groups within that, so for instance, Black residents in Vancouver, they are experiencing higher pollution burdens. So your question of like why that might be and how does that relate to different where people live, yeah. So it absolutely has to do with these questions of residential concentration or segregation. So for instance, I mentioned that Indigenous residents face pretty high cumulative pollution burdens in Vancouver. A lot of that has to do with the fact that there's a high percentage of Indigenous households concentrated in the Strathcona region, the downtown east side. And those are areas in Vancouver where there are also a high concentration of air pollution sources. So like traffic was something I mentioned. That's actually a place where you get, you know, rail terminals. There's like a lot of trucking activity there, shipping activity. And so the confluence of those things, like when you bring those two things together, then, you know, we start to see these kinds of patterns. In terms of where different communities live, it's a really complex question. It has to do with lots of intersecting factors, right? Like immigration patterns, socioeconomic status. And so that's one of the reasons why I think we see these different patterns across the different cities. It does also relate to the fact that there have been different settlement patterns for different communities in different cities across Canada.
Interesting.
Do you think the different exposure to air pollution is necessarily intentional, or is it basically just poor city planning that it wasn't just taken into account?
That's also a complex question. I would say no, air pollution is intentional in the sense that of course I think there's an understanding that you know, air pollution is a contributor to negative health outcomes, and, you know, of course, like everyone wants to reduce that. But this question of why do we see these inequalities in exposure, it absolutely does have to do with things like access to political process. So like, let's say we're going to cite some sort of industrial facility that emits a lot of air pollutants. And there's this question of like, where are we going to put it? And often, you know, like, let's say if we were going to cite that facility in, let's say, like an affluent community with a lot of social capital, often that means that community has the financial resources, the political resources, the social capital to effectively stop that from happening, right? Like, you know, they can organize, they might, lobby politicians. Like, there's a reason why we don't see these polluting facilities as often in, let's say, these affluent neighborhoods, right? But, you know, like, let's say in a low-income neighborhood where, you know, people don't necessarily have the same time and resources to organize against this, then, you know, it's much more likely then that you see these polluting facilities being sited in these communities. And then there can be feedbacks too, right? So like, let's say there is a neighborhood where there is a facility that emits a lot of air pollution. That likely means that the housing prices around that facility are going to be lowered because that's a negative attribute, let's say, about the environment. Just like, you know, having a really good school is something that might increase the housing prices in a neighborhood, right? Like, that's an amenity, it's a benefit that people want. So over time, you can see how these things can kind of reinforce themselves and create these patterns where some communities, sometimes like this term sacrifice zone is used, and it's this idea that like there are some places where like we put all of, you know, like the dirty emitting facilities, and those communities, those like frontline communities nearby, really bear the brunt because often like the city as a whole or the region as a whole or the economy as a whole benefits from that production.
Yeah, so it does sound like a very complex and multifaceted problem. What first steps do you think municipalities could take in sort of improving this disproportionate difference?
Yeah, I think one of the first things that municipalities could do is, and that they are definitely starting to do, is explicitly consider this when they're making different sorts of planning and assessment decisions. So it's in Canada, in many places in Canada, it's not required to actually look at this as a dimension of decision-making. You know, often when we're going to, let's say, make a decision about which bus route should we electrify first? Let's say like that's a sort of question that maybe like a local transit authority would make. With the idea that, you know, like if you electrify that bus, you're reducing air pollution emissions and, you know, there are some benefits there. You know, one of the first things that would be looked at often is something like cost, right? Like, okay, well, how much will this cost? And safety is also something else that, you know, we might look at. But these equity considerations of like, okay, well, like what does this mean in terms of which communities might benefit health-wise if this happens, that's something that doesn't happen quite as often, but it's starting to change. And I think that's one of the examples where this kind of, one of the promising developments in this space is that like more and more authorities are starting to think like, okay, like how do we incorporate equity as something that we take into account in our decision-making so that, you know, when we think about, you know, like where should we put our resources, let's say like electrifying this bus line or investing in a park or thinking about the distribution of benefits. So not just like the total amount, but who benefits and who loses.
Great. We'll be right back on Research Review after just one short message. So please stay tuned.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirot, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Jiang. So far, we've been talking a bit about the issue of air pollution, specifically in Vancouver, and how there are a lot of inequalities associated with this issue, such as certain neighborhoods being disproportionately affected. Now, Gurman, you had a question for Dr. Jiang.
Do you think that the average Vancouverite is necessarily concerned about equity at the moment?
Do I think that the average Vancouverite is consumed? Well, you know, one of the things that recently happened in environmental policy in Vancouver is Vancouver, the Climate Emergency Action Plan. And that's something that, you know, had broad support in Vancouver City Council. And one of the core dimensions of that is equity. I think that was like a great example of local policy planning that really put equity at the core. And I think a lot of that also has to do with youth movements that are like pushing for policymakers to think in this way. This is true, like, not just in Vancouver. I think, you know, like when you think of the Green New Deal, for instance, in the U.S., or the movement for climate justice that's, you know, like happening in Vancouver and in many other places. I think there is a growing understanding that equity is a core part of a lot of that, you know, for instance, like without social equity, we will not be able to achieve many of the other goals that we want to achieve. These things are interconnected. And so I think there is a push to see that kind of change in policy making and environmental policy making in particular.
In your article, you do reference environmental justice movements quite a bit, and it did seem like an interesting topic just because I've never actually heard it expressed in that way before. I know environmental justice movements have happened throughout the years. I just never saw it as one connected thing. Like, there were always examples throughout the years with Hurricane Katrina and then Kanye talking about how George Bush doesn't care about Black people, or what happened in Flint, Michigan, for example, where it's basically a minority-dominated community. So we do see those environmental justice issues brought to the forefront quite a bit, but I've never seen it described as a movement before. What would you say the current state of the environmental justice movement is currently?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to preface this by saying, like, I am not a social movement scholar. Hopefully get someone who can invite someone who is. I think one of the, from my understanding, one of the exciting things about environmental justice is that it's not just one thing, right? And it really emerged out of grassroots organizing from a lot of different communities. And so I think what we're seeing, though, is that, like, what is exciting is that, like, you have these grassroots movements happening in lots of different places. Like you mentioned, you know, there are all these different discrete environmental injustice events. And as, you know, we see the systemic connections between more of those and are able to find different kinds of solidarities across these, you know, discrete events, I think that's what allows for the increasing uptake also in policy spaces. And yeah, I was going to say something else, but let's leave it. Or okay, maybe I will say that there's this one last part that I just wanted to add about environmental justice, and that environmental justice itself is a really super multifaceted concept as well. The work that we've mostly been talking about today really focuses on that distributional element. So, like I mentioned, like the distribution of environmental risks, and then also access to environmental benefits, like things like green space. So that's one aspect of environmental justice, but there are other dimensions of it as well. Like, people also often talk about a procedural dimension of environmental justice, and that links to what I was talking about earlier in terms of access to the environmental decision making process, like making sure everyone is equally involved in terms of making decisions about the environment. That's like another dimension of environmental justice too, which is a little different, right? It's not just about the environmental outcomes, it's like about decision making processes. So maybe I'll just like leave it there just to say that I think, you know, when we talk about environmental justice, it's not just about the distributional dimensions, but also dimensions of like process, and then also dimensions of like whose voices and whose perspectives and whose knowledge is recognized as valid in participating in that process.
Great. We'll be right back on Research Review after just one short message.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirot, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Jiang. So far, we've been talking a bit about the issue of air pollution, specifically in Vancouver, and how there are a lot of inequalities associated with this issue. Now, you know, just going back to like the whole issue of pollution and all that stuff. Let me just pose a little question, or should I say, more of a scenario. You know, we saw in your research some of the maps. Of course, they showed areas such as downtown Vancouver. They do have a lot of pollution, and of course, that's perhaps like, you know, due to a lot of the industrial activities going on there. The major roads passing through a lot of the population, you would say that's true, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, also at the same time, you know, in downtown Vancouver, you know, we might have the downtown east side, which is, of course, one of the most impoverished neighborhoods in Canada. And then you go a few blocks over and you're probably, like, looking at some place like Cole Harbour, multi-million dollar condos, but really in the same geographic scale. But, you know, one thing I was wondering is that, and this is something that I've taken a look at in like some previous public health courses that I looked at. Imagine, you know, you have two people. So say, you know, it's me and Gurman. We're living at the same intersection. And Gurman, you know, he lives across the street in an older building. Maybe it's a three-story wood frame building. It's pretty old. It's not that new. You know, he has to keep the window open because there's not a lot of ventilation going on. And say I live across the street in this brand new high-rise building, say like on the 40th floor or something, and it's, you know, it's got all the latest insulated windows and good ventilation. And, you know, that really brings the question to account that even though, you know, say both of us in that situation, we're living, say, in the same geographic area, we're having really different experiences. For example, Gurman, he's right there at street level. He might be exposed to a lot more air pollution than I would be, hypothetically, in that situation. Is that something that, you know, for example, there's been like research to take that into account, you would say?
Yeah, that's a really great point, and highlights a big limitation of the work that we did in this study and that, you know, other similar studies do, which is, like you said, like a lot of this is based on, well, like there are many assumptions. So like the first thing is that census data is based on where people live, right? And it, like, reality, well, this is maybe more true now during the pandemic, like, but when the pandemic wasn't happening, you weren't at home all the time. So like where you live is not necessarily a great indication of exactly what you're breathing, like the whole day, right? So that's the first thing, is that like residential exposure is not necessarily the same as what we would call personal exposure, and personal exposure being like exactly what you're breathing throughout the day. And that takes into account not only where you live, but also where you, you know, work, where you learn, where you play, like, you know, like you can think about how you move through space. So yeah, that's one thing that, you know, often when you're using census data, like we're not capturing that because we're just looking at where people live. And of course, like if we could capture, you know, exactly, you know, personal exposure, it would give us an even better picture of what, you know, what people are actually exposed to. But then that second part of like, okay, even if we were just looking at like where people live, you mentioned this really important point of that, like, you know, you can have a really different air pollution experience, even if you're like physically located in the same place, due to some of these other factors. And that's really important. And I think is one of the things that's kind of like at the frontiers, or like what people are working on right now, is to try to better understand how those factors also influence exposure. And in particular, like you mentioned, that kind of like indoor outdoor connection, something where it's like, okay, yeah, like depending on the aspects of the built, do I live in a fancy new building that's like a passive house thing, so like there's not a lot of, but I also have like a really good HVAC system, so I'm getting good ventilation, versus like you said, like, yeah, someone who has to open up their window. So I think that getting into that level of granularity and trying to understand like how getting even more granular about what environment is, like down to the level of like what is my experience of the built environment, really matters. And I think, you know, when we talked about these different dimensions of like social stratification, like they have an influence there as well, right? Like, you know, like it doesn't just influence like what postal code I live in, but it also influences the experience I have at that postal code. So I think one of the I think big data is really exciting, but I also think sometimes there's like, you know, it can get overhyped. But one of the exciting things about the ability to collect data more granularly and have more data is that we can get a better picture of that more, personalized experience. We can get better ideas about personal exposure. And then also maybe we can start to take into account some of the factors that you mentioned. And that's definitely something that they're doing in public health and in epidemiology. Like those would be some of the variables that they would want to take into account in terms of thinking about like, okay, like even though they're living in the same place, like why might they be experiencing different health outcomes?
That's definitely interesting insight on that. And, you know, one other just question about the whole like, geographic aspect of the study that, because I noticed, you know, you mentioned that you looked at Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal, and there's some interesting findings that you saw in Vancouver. For example, out of these three cities, it had the highest level of social inequities. But just one question I have, you know, when you look at the city of Montreal and the city of Toronto per se, so city of Montreal is almost 2 million population, city of Toronto is almost 3 million population, but Vancouver is only 600,000 population. So when you look at the Vancouver metropolitan area, like the city of Vancouver itself is a very small portion of that. And especially when you're looking at like racialized communities, marginalized communities in the Vancouver suburbs, say like Burnaby, Richmond, Surrey, there's a lot of population as well. And is there any particular reason why those communities were not studied?
Yeah, again, like that's a really good question. And in this study, like you said, we just focused on the municipality, not the greater metro area. The reason for that, again, goes back to the census unit question. So, and this like loops back to one of your early questions about just like, what is the nature of the different sorts of data sources we have? Because we're matching the air pollution data to the demographic data, the scale of the demographic data in some cases might be coarser, and that's the scale at which we're trying to do the matching. And so when you're just focused on the municipality alone, those the census geographies or those dissemination areas, they end up being more similar in size, which makes it easier to do that matching to the air pollution data in the sense that like we kind of have to like aggregate or like do that correspondence. And so if each unit of each like census unit is about the same size, there's less exposure error, I guess. And so one of the reasons we didn't in this study look at the metro area more broadly, especially in Vancouver, is then that you get huge variance then in the size of those census units once you expand and look at it in that way. But I think, like you said, it would be a really important next thing to look at, especially when you consider like settlement patterns and these patterns of where people live, right? And there are huge differences, yeah, like in terms of who is living in, the suburbs just outside of Vancouver. And this is actually something that we did see in Toronto, Montreal. So Toronto in particular, like it's a much more amalgamated city. So like the municipal area itself contains what we would call like inner suburbs. And definitely one of the things that we found are that these inner suburbs are often cumulative pollution hotspots, actually. You know, like often people think like, oh, like it's going to be the downtown core. But, you know, like when you look in these outer suburbs, these are areas where there still is a lot of traffic, and then often like due to zoning reasons you sometimes get more industrial activity, and that's actually where in Toronto and Montreal we were seeing a lot of these cumulative pollution hotspots. And often we also see they're also kind of changing settlement and immigration patterns, for instance, where that like a lot of immigrant communities are increasingly settling in these like, inner suburb regions. So you're absolutely right. Like Vancouver, it's a less of an amalgamated urban like municipality than the other two cities we looked at.
It's definitely interesting. You know, it's good to see there are a lot of questions that you could potentially pursue for future research. So
yeah,
exciting to see. You know, I think
I definitely think that when you study things like pollution, like it's almost like I wish there was less. Just like it would be a better world if there wasn't so much to study. But as a researcher, certainly, I think like there are a lot of interesting and important questions that we can explore.
Definitely, there's a lot of there's a lot of stuff that I read about every day. For example, you know, you've probably heard about electric cars. Those are coming, pretty exciting. That might have an impact on urban pollution. But one other thing I also heard was that a lot of the particulate matter that comes from vehicles is not due to exhaust, but it's actually due to tire friction and brake pads, which is especially interesting at because when you think about urban intersections, there's a lot of acceleration, deacceleration. And, you know, that leaves me to wonder, you know, if we're looking in the future 10, 20 years from now when we have a lot more electric cars, what's the pollution going to look like from that in that aspect?
That's a really interesting question. And I will maybe just do a shout out to my colleague, Dr. Naomi Zimmerman in mechanical engineering, who is an expert on this specific topic. But I will try to share some of the wisdom that I have acquired from her about this topic. And maybe she might be someone that you can talk to in the future. But yeah, absolutely. It's not just what we would call there are tailpipe emissions, exhaust emissions. And then, yeah, things from things like tire wear, brake wear. And one of the interesting things is that, you know, you mentioned particulate matter, or particulate matter is definitely something that contributes majorly to some of these adverse health impacts. But there are different kinds of particulate matter. Particulate matter might be made of different sorts of things. And depending on what it is composed of, it also has different implications for health impacts. So one of the things that people are interested in is, for instance, are heavy metals within particulate matter, particularly tied to some of the negative health impacts we see. And those are the sorts of things that you might see more of in terms of something like brake wear, right? That might be a source of this kind of heavy metal pollution. So this question of so even if we were to, fully electrify and reduce the tailpipe emissions, absolutely, there still would be these non-tailpipe emissions associated with traffic. And I think that's one of the research questions that folks like Naomi are working on.
Definitely. You know, there's a lot of different avenues of research to pursue for you here. But, you know, I definitely appreciate this research that you've done, because I find it it's very useful from both an environmental, from policy perspective, because I've seen a lot of research sort of in this area that's been done in the United States, but not so much in Canada. So it's definitely nice to have that data emerging now. And again, I think I would like to thank you for coming on to Research Review. Do you have anything else to say, Gurman?
Yeah, I guess maybe just one last question to wrap it up. How could people like you and me and people listening maybe get involved in addressing environmental injustice?
Lots of ways, so many ways. One way is, and this is true for a lot of different environmental issues, is certainly with your vote. Different politicians have made environmental justice a bigger or smaller part of their platforms. And so, choosing who are our policymakers is certainly a really important part of this. Another is, of course, there are lots of grassroots, there are lots of NGOs, grassroots organizations that are working on this issue. And, if helpful, I can maybe send a list of them that, I don't know, maybe you could include online with this, because that's absolutely a way to get involved. But then, even if you're not involved, let's say, in one of those organizations, I mentioned things like citing decisions and other things that are really things that you can get involved in as a local resident. Having getting involved, asking those questions is absolutely a way that you can, also have an impact with respect to some of these environmental injustices. So, take an interest in the sorts of environmental decision making that's happening in your community, that's an opportunity for all of us to kind of like raise these issues when these decisions are being made.
Yeah, I'll definitely take that one to heart. Thank you so much for coming on to our show. It was definitely a pleasure listening to you speak on this topic.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM with Alirad and Gurmad.